You are listening to The Circled Eight on Resonance 104.4 FM. On the show tonight, we have Peter Gelderlos. He's an activist and author from the US in Virginia. His books include How Nonviolence Protects the State, Consensus, and Anarchy Works. Hello, Peter.
Hi.
Hello. Okay, let's fire away with the questions. Why are you an anarchist? What is it that attracted you to the philosophy? And when did you first start considering yourself an anarchist? And were there any groups or individuals that influenced this decision?
I guess I started considering myself an anarchist as soon as I came in contact with anarchist philosophy, anarchist histories, which I have to say was not so easy. It's something that often quite invisibilized. And it just made a lot of sense to me, in contrast with the histories of many other attempts to change the world that have ended up reproducing the same power structures and their dynamics. And I guess this was also the time, at the end of the 90s, the beginning of the aughts, when within anti-globalization movements and anti-war movements, there were different debates going on about both strategies and goals of what we mean by freedom, what a better world looks like. I guess it's also worth pointing out that a big influence was the examples given by authority figures themselves, and a certain commonality. One could even think of it as a sort of a pathology or a sort of a social disease that can be seen in all of these institutions that we're subjected to, whether it's the school system or the healthcare system, prisons, and just how unhealthy this logic of authority was.
And a book that you've written that has influenced many people's thinking towards effective tactics of struggle is How Nonviolence Protects the State. I'd like to talk to you about some of the points outlined in the chapters. Some activists often quote Gandhi, projecting the idea that nonviolence has a moral high ground. Can you talk us through relevant historical examples of where nonviolence has been ineffective and what's happened with this evidence?
Uh-huh, absolutely.
Thank you.
Well, the independence movement in India itself is an interesting example. I wouldn't say that nonviolence was ineffective, but I would question what effect it had. Of course, that's a movement that wasn't strictly nonviolent. There were also many riots that had an important part in that movement, a sort of underlying level of violence and social tension. There were armed currents of that movement, and the British chose to negotiate with the nonviolent portion of the movement in order to help a local Indian elite establish what can most accurately be described as a neo-colonial system of government and economy. In the civil rights movement in the United States, it's often ignored how or forgotten how the tactics of Martin Luther King's organization were a total failure in Albany, Georgia, and then they repeated the same tactics later in Birmingham, which is the incident that's most remembered for pressuring the federal government to actually support the Civil Rights Act and make sure that it got put into practice. But that episode, only the beginning is remembered, the nonviolent campaign, and not how the locals sort of rebelling against the leadership of King's organization that came from the outside started rioting and fighting with police when they decided that it wasn't dignified to just accept this violence. And they actually took over the city and kicked out the police. And it was immediately after that some of the biggest victories of the civil rights movement were won. And I think those lessons are remembered in a certain way on the streets by how little faith people who aren't representing some NGO or the universities or the middle class put in nonviolence, as we can see in the uprisings around the U.S. Related to Ferguson and other police killings. The anti-war movement in 2003 is a great example. It was the biggest protest that the world had ever seen. They were exclusively nonviolent, and in the aftermath, pro-nonviolent pacifist organizations who had really fooled themselves on their own manipulated history of events predicted that the force of that demonstration of nonviolence would prevent the war. And we saw how untrue that proved to be, and also how quickly that movement died, how it sort of killed itself with this stifling insistence on nonviolence, which prevented a sort of more natural, organic evolution of tactics and strategies.
And how do you think people in, for example, the US have been de-radicalized? And what has been the process in the last several decades?
The media have definitely played a large role in that. But since self-criticism is always, I think, more useful than blaming an outside force, I think we can also look at how street politics has been done in the US. We can look at how disempowering it is to participate in the NGO mode of social activism or to participate in lobbying politicians for change, because that makes sure that power is never in our hands. People will quickly give up on a movement that is hierarchical, disempowering, and focused on institutional reforms that may make certain living conditions better in the short run, but that never overcome that fundamental alienation in which our lives are organized by other people, in which we're not actually allowed to organize our own life.
And back to the US, we still see countless killings of black and ethnic minorities at the hands of the police, and have seen a rise in resistance from the movements such as Black Lives Matter, and an interest in previous historical examples like the Black Panther Party. In your book, you state that nonviolence is racist. Can you explain exactly what you mean by this? Because it's really interesting.
That's in reference to, I guess, how nonviolence worked as, and often still works today, as a social complex, sort of interrelation between different groups of actors. To start with, it's necessary, I think, to point out that any individual or any group of people of whatever race can have a very legitimate reason for deciding that they only want to use peaceful actions. But if you take beyond the individual level, a broader analysis of these interplays of power in movements like the civil rights movement back in the 60s, or movements around popular responses to Ferguson and different police killings in the U.S., we can see these dynamics where more authoritarian or more professional groups, whether these are NGOs or activist organizations with paid organizers, often support nonviolence. They attempt to monopolize the discourse in the media, and they also join in with the media and with the police in delegitimizing all of those who don't support nonviolence. May often have figureheads or spokespersons who are non-white. They also may try to portray their opponents as being white outside agitators, as happened in the case of Ferguson, when a huge part of Ferguson residents themselves chose to use combative rather than peaceful tactics as their response to a friend and neighbor getting brutally killed by police. And all of those, in the case of Ferguson, all of those black residents are invisibilized and delegitimized when they are either left out of the picture or portrayed as simple tools and puppets of these white anarchists who are coming in from outside. That discourse, which is used by more professional activists, by the media, by the police, is racist in the first instance, and how it sort of disappears the participation of people of color in their decisions. And then on a larger level, we also see how liberal white donors with like a guilty white conscience, or how predominantly white NGOs and so forth give money to and give a lot of power to these organizations that are spreading the kind of discourse that they want to hear. So Martin Luther King's organization, for example, really would not have existed as such without these liberal white donors, who certainly never would have given support to a more radical black organization. And so that's another level at which racism plays out and uses nonviolence as a tool.
And it is sometimes claimed that violence is a masculine response, whereas nonviolence is a feminine response. One of my favourite chapters is about how nonviolence is inherently patriarchal. Could you elaborate on this point?
Sure. I think there are many good criticisms to be made, first off, about how traditionally masculine activities are more valued in social movements. So criticisms of patriarchal dynamics in social movements, I think, are absolutely important. However, the interpretation of that, which, like you said, casts activities of self-defense, more combative activities as masculine, and peaceful tactics as feminine, in the end uses the same social equation as, for example, the Bible, in making sure that violence is monopolized by men and that women have to be and can only be exclusively peaceful. In all of the important anti-patriarchal movements that I've ever witnessed or been able to find any historical reference to, violence used by women, by queer people, by transgender people, by other people who are left out of this heterosexual patriarchal binary, played an extremely important role. And the very existence, the very use of fighting back, defending themselves when those activities are carried out by women or by trans people or by queer people, that very fact upsets the moral hierarchy of patriarchy.
Ultimately, who benefits from the division between violence and nonviolence in the social justice movement?
I think the police and power structures in general are the main benefactors. I think it's a sterile debate in the end between nonviolence and violence. When I criticize nonviolence, it's not because I'm taking up the opposite position, because I'm championing violence, but because I'm opposing that very dichotomy. It's not at all useful for our struggles, our social movements, to debate and split hairs on whether a specific tactic or action is violent or nonviolent. This is a category that belongs to the media, to the police, who want to delegitimize what we do. We should be asking ourselves whether a tactic is effective and whether a tactic is liberatory, whether it's empowering for the people who take part in it, and whether it spreads that empowerment, as opposed to being belonging to practices of social movements that create new forms of authority and new hierarchies.
And the debate between violence and nonviolence seems to have been going on for decades now. What do you personally see as the future possibilities for revolutionary activism? And let's talk about your more recent book on peaceful protest entitled The Failure of Nonviolence. Looking back, how do you reflect on this relevant global civil unrest?
I think that in many of these different social uprisings, it's become apparent much more rapidly that people are giving up on nonviolence. They use it and they see that an exclusive practice of nonviolence, as opposed to a diversity of tactics, as opposed to choosing whatever tactics are most appropriate to the situation and to their needs and preferences, is ineffective, that nonviolence does not meet their needs. And this shows that the power of this narrative, founded, as we talked about, on these manipulative histories, is losing its ability to convince people. So on the one hand, this shows a sort of global evolution in strategic thinking and tactics that are available to people, and it's also showed a new set of limits. A lot of these movements have focused, instead of on protest, instead of on convincing politicians, on seizing space, on taking over space, whether that's to hold assemblies or to stop gentrification projects or to spread a new model of the city and of neighborhoods. And so within that context, it's much easier to realize that combative and disruptive tactics are necessary, that nonviolent tactics have not at all been effective, haven't enabled them to take over space. But the next set of questions largely has to do with what do we do with that space? It has to do with recovering the knowledge necessary for organizing our own lives on a practical level, not just the symbolic assembly, but at all the levels, in terms of feeding ourselves, housing ourselves, whether we continue to rely on state institutions or private institutions, or whether we create something ourselves that responds directly to our needs rather than what those in power tell us our needs should be. And that also in the very act of being created, enrich us, transform us from passive consumers into the principal actors in our own lives. So in some of these, like with the Occupy movement, the Pause Occupation movement, we've seen sort of a failure as a more political conception of the assembly fails to change people's lives, fails to solve all of these various problems. And I think for that reason, in countries where you had these Pause Occupation movements, there's a renewed faith in these far left parties. People gave assembly-based movements a try. It didn't immediately produce the change they were seeking, so they're willing to give yet another chance to the far left parties with this idea of institutional change, which has failed so many times in the past. And I think that's in part because there was a failure, there was a lack of models of self-organization, not just in an abstract assembly, but at a much deeper level, dealing with all the aspects of life, food, healthcare, housing, and so forth.
In your book, Anarchy Works, some of the big social questions are thoroughly outlined, such as how do we deal with crime, the economy, or healthcare? Can you run us through these concepts of how a society can be run in a socialist libertarian way? How do you see anarchism working as a viable day-to-day political framework that will improve the lives of people across the globe on a local scale and an international scale?
I think one of the most important points is that there's no universal model or blueprint. The most important element is that people learn how to organize to meet these different needs themselves, both because there's not one answer, there's not one size of society that fits all. People need to adapt whatever solution they come up with to their local ecosystem, to their culture, to their history, to their specific needs. And also because it's not the result of the product, it's not the specific answer or blueprint of social organization in which we can find our freedom and well-being, but in the fact that we're the ones who are organizing our own lives. So one of the first characteristics of an anarchist response to these different social problems is that there's not an emphasis on one correct answer, but the emphasis is in fact on the process. And I think that a thorough and an honest look at human history shows beyond any doubt that humans have a very high capacity for self-organization, whether that's on a long timeline, the fact that more human societies have been stateless than have existed under states, that many of these stateless societies have been extremely effective at creating a healthy and sustainable relationship with their environment, feeding themselves, supplying themselves. A number of these societies have also impacted in very large cuts, or in cases when governments collapse. There are countless historic examples of governments collapsing and people organizing to meet their own survival, often better than when the state was in power. So there's not one easy answer that can be given to people, and I think that's often the problem, is that left politics creates this expectation for easy answers. The answer is not in some magic recipe or blueprint, but in the very process itself of people organizing to meet their own needs.
Now you are living in Spain, which has a deep history in resistance and rebellion. And in 2014, you came to the London Anarchist Book Fair to talk about private space, public space, communal space, anarchist participation in the struggle of Barcelona, for Barcelona. What has been your experience of organizing in Spain, and how has it developed your politics?
Here it's been really interesting, just everything that we learn in contrast or with different examples. Some of the really useful characteristics of social movements here is their emphasis on history, making sure that historical memory is alive and well collectively, that history lives on in the streets. This serves to preserve a lot of lessons from past struggles, so that people don't always have to repeat the same mistakes, and gives a sort of broader analysis. So, for example, Spain was a country that was under a fascist dictatorship until the 1970s, and then it transferred rather seamlessly into a democratic system. And holding on to this memory helps people see through a lot of the tricks that democratic governments use to maintain power. It reveals a lot of the falseness of this democratic mythology that one kind of government is fundamentally different from another kind, just because of how people can see that there was an institutional continuity, that many of the same institutions remained intact, many of the same practices remained intact. That's very important, I think, just keeping the history of our social movements alive.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the prevalence of social centers, of also using culture as a way to hold on to space, and what's often described as public space is space that's owned and controlled by the state, which really isn't much better than private space. But this can give us an idea of the possibility of communal space, of space that's controlled by residents and inhabitants themselves, controlled by the people who live in a neighborhood and not the interests that are trying to profit off a neighborhood or to govern a neighborhood. And some of that is done in more formal ways, with like the practice of assemblies or social centers, also transforming the city. And it can also be done informally with a culture of festivities that, instead of being organized by the government, are organized by associations of neighbors themselves.
And one of the biggest crises in our lifetime currently underway is the migrant and asylum seekers fleeing their homelands. Outside of the narrative of the mainstream news, what do you attribute to this phenomenal number increase? And what do you think about borders and nation states? And what do you think the response from, say, the EU will be, as opposed to should be?
I think that borders and nation states inherently divide us. I mean, that's an obvious statement, but I think its implications need to be more deeply considered. One of the purposes and one of the functions of nation states are to make us think that we have more in common with the rich and the powerful who essentially own us than we do with other people in the same condition as ourselves in other countries. They make us think that differences of culture and language are more important than absolute differences in access to power. As far as the last question, I don't think that we should be thinking in terms of what the European Union should do. because I don't think that hierarchical structures like that are capable of making decisions in our interests. And I think we also need to question the humanitarian rhetoric that sometimes comes from structures. For example, when Angela Merkel decided to welcome refugees, shortly after the president of the Business Owners Association of Germany talked about how much Germany needed more skilled labor, and how by opening up the borders on a relative scale, the German economy could profit, business owners could profit by basically appropriating university-educated middle class fleeing the civil war in Syria and elsewhere. So both when the official structures are spreading discourse xenophobia and fear, or whether they're spreading humanitarian discourses, in both cases it's for very bad reasons. Also, it's worth pointing out that a lot of these governments have made grandiose promises about how many refugees they would accept, but up to the present moment, they've delivered very little. I don't know the statistics for all the countries in the European Union, but I know that in Spain, for example, the number of refugees that they've actually brought in and settled is extremely low. Like, definitely not in the thousands, more in the dozens. And at the same time, self-organized action by refugees themselves, by people acting in solidarity all across Europe. For example, there have been a number of recent articles about anarchists organizing refugee shelters in Greece. Has made a difference, a direct difference in the lives of thousands of people. And if more of us dedicated our attentions to these self-organized direct responses, rather than just sitting watching the television and raising our hands, or rather than sending money to NGOs, then we could accomplish a whole lot more.
We've got time just for one last question, and if you could answer it in 2 minutes, then I'd be very grateful. So, I'm loving this conversation, by the way. But lastly, often people express doubts about the degree of faith to place in human nature, that a society without state control would lead to anarchy in the most negative sense, that chaos would ensue and life would be far worse for many than it is now. What's your response?
I think that's just a reflection of how education is controlled by the state, and in many cases is nothing more than mythology that trains us to accept the inevitability and the goodness of living under states. It has absolutely no backing in history, in archaeology, in the social sciences. It's well known that, and well demonstrated, that when there's, for example, a natural disaster, people tend to self-organize spontaneously, and that most of the first responses and the most effective responses at saving lives are not carried out by governments, but by people themselves. For example, Hurricane Katrina in the United States 10 years ago, the government was there shooting looters, shooting people who were trying to get water so that they could survive, and it was neighbors themselves who were carrying out most of the rescues in the first phase. Also, as I mentioned before, the majority of human history has been stateless. States are a global phenomenon now, mostly because of European colonialism. The structures that were imposed violently, and prior to this, many societies in many different ways organized themselves. Some with weaker forms of hierarchy, and others actually in a non-hierarchical, non-authoritarian way. And there's no evidence. In fact, all the contrary. These states, people tend to have better access to food, housing, healthcare, and all the rest. It's in fact inequality that's directly associated with the rise of state power.
Thank you, Peter, so much for your time. Some of your publications are available online, I think on anarchistlibrary.org, the website it's called.
Yep.
And for those who are interested in reading more about this and your work, thank you. And you've been listening to The Circle Day on Resonance. Till next week, turn on, tune in and kick off.